Okay, Proverbs 25. As we've been studying the book of Proverbs, have you ever had any moments where you just sort of found some of the things kind of jumping off the page at you and you think, he's talking to me. That is directed straight at me. These words are 3,000 years old. You know, it's very tempting to take words written that long ago and say, what benefit does that have to me? These things are beneficial. They are just as important and just as necessary for us today as they were when they were recorded. The next two chapters, we're going to look at the characteristics of the wise and of fools. That's going to come out a lot. Which one describes me? Now, if I'm being honest, my behavior and my thought process, am I more like the wise or am I more like a fool? And I need to just lay it open and be honest with myself as I go through these things. Which do I behave more like? And if the answer is a fool, I need to fix it. I'm not guaranteed any more time. I need to fix it now. The tongue is the real measure of one's heart. I was talking with someone the other day about just things that needed to be changed. And I said, well, I love the Lord. I'm just not willing to do this. You know, our actions and our words reflect what's really in our heart. That's what shows. If I really love Him, then I'll do what He said. And I will speak His ways and His things. Because I can lie to myself and say, oh, I love Him, I love Him. Now, I'm not going to obey, but I love Him. That's not what He says. Yeah, I need to make sure that I see that as well. Certainly we can go to Matthew 12 and look at how the words spoken are a reflection of one's heart, but we realize that. Another point to keep in mind, how do we respond to instruction? While we're going through these words, if I see something that points out error in my life, what do I do then? Because the easy reaction and what seems to be a lot of times the natural reaction is to dig my heels in and to stiffen my neck and to just kind of harden my heart and say, I don't care what you teach. I'm going to keep believing what I've always believed. That's what fools do. The wise listen and they take it in. And if it is God's word and if it's truth and if I'm opposed to it, their hearts melt and they do what's right. Which one is me? Which way am I behaving? Seems like, apparently, if you look at verse 1 there, these also are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied. It appears that chapters 25 through 29, they are Proverbs written by Solomon, but this particular group of Proverbs was compiled by the men of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, king of Judah, who lived about 200 years after Solomon, wanted these particular Proverbs bound together and kept together. They were something that he saw a great need for. And we don't have all of the details, but we're told his men compiled these together. These are still certainly inspired. They are the words of Solomon, but Hezekiah is the one who put them together. Look at verses 2 and 3. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter. As the heavens for height and the earth for depth, so the heart of kings is unsearchable. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing. Turn to Deuteronomy 29. You know, we live in a world where knowledge is so accessible to us, and it's just so easy to get with the internet, especially. For those of us who have trouble keeping our attention focused on things. I don't know if the internet is a blessing or a curse, because anytime something pops in my mind, I can just go look it up and find out exactly what it is, which sidetracks me for the next 30 minutes usually, because I think of something else and something else. But that being said, that accessibility might make it to where I think, you know what, I should be able to get the answer to every single question. Everything in the world that I want to know the answer to, I should be able to have. That's just not the case. There's some things that are hidden from us. Deuteronomy 29, verse 29, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. There are some questions I want answers to that I will never get the answer. I won't, and I don't have to. Some things are His, but what is ours? The revealed things are ours. This book, it's ours. Those things have been given to us, not only us, but to our children. These are the things that we need to make sure we know. You know, I can chase after all that other stuff on the internet. I need to make sure that I have an understanding of this. With that in mind, going back to Proverbs 25. Honorable kings search out a matter. Solomon did that. Hezekiah did that. Both of them did. Kings also conceal some things. Do you believe that? Kings conceal some things. And here's the part that may make us angry. They have a right, and it is wise for them to conceal some things. Now, when you first hear that, as Americans, we think, oh, wait a minute, no, they can't hide. If a king goes on the air today and tells everybody his battle plan, is that wise? Absolute foolishness. It is one of those things, and I hope you don't think ill of me. There are times when I have seen reporters in war zones giving information, and I just want to scream at the television, because if I were a terrorist, I wouldn't worry about getting intel. I would just watch CNN. They will tell me everything I need to know about what the Americans are doing. It blows my mind and it makes me crazy at the same time. I know that we have freedom. I know all that. But sometimes it's just not wise to tell everybody what you're doing. Now, are there times where kings withhold information from their people that they should tell them? Of course. But there is a time where not everybody needs to know everything about every situation. And so here we see the glory of kings is to search out a matter. And the heart of a king is unsearchable. There are some things that are hidden. John, go ahead.
It also makes you think about, you know, God and His infinite wisdom. You know, He's got the right to conceal things, but even a king's a man, and he's got to search out things for understanding.
Yeah.
Even a person of stature, he's got to go look for it.
Yeah. We're talking Solomon and Hezekiah, right? I mean, they had all the authority over Israel, and yet they searched. They were diligent to find those things of God because they were that important. Very, very good point. Verses 4 and 5. Take away the dross from silver, and it will go to the silversmith for jewelry. Take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness. What is dross, first of all?
Yeah.
When metal is being treated to remove the impurities, the dross is the impurities. It's a waste product. It's also metallic in nature, but it's not like the pure silver. It's the bad stuff, if you will. And when that's removed, in what shape does it leave the silver or the gold or whatever?
Pure.
Pure, yeah. Yeah, the dross needs to be removed. Take away the dross from the silver, and then it'll go to the silversmith for jewelry. The silversmith knows, I need the pure stuff before I can make those precious things out of it. The bad things need to be removed. Similarly, you've got a comparison to wickedness. Where does it need to go if a king's throne is going to be righteous? Where does the wickedness have to go?
It has to go away.
It has to be put away. It has to be, because you can't have wickedness there with the throne and expect the throne to be standing for righteousness. It has to be removed. This idea we've seen already, if you go back to chapter 14, verse 34, and the point we made, a number of points when we went through that, but it says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. It's the same. You can't have both. You know, if a nation is going to be righteous, and if its king is going to do righteous things, the wickedness has to be put away. Otherwise, it's going to be pulling in an opposite direction. Any thoughts you guys want to bring up on those? Being a king or ruler of any sort, it is difficult stuff. It is difficult. It is perhaps not the job that many of us would want to endeavor to do. I don't want it. And I say that to say, I know we don't always agree with our rulers. Do we pray for them? It's easy to criticize. It is so easy when I'm sitting in my house with all my illustrious wisdom, with my feet up on my ottoman, to pass judgments on the nation of what I should do. And there are things we can see that are wrong. I'm not saying that. But do I pray? Do I do anything about it? Or do I just gripe? Or do I pray for those who have leadership positions, governors, mayors, presidents, congressmen? Do we pray for them? Or do we just criticize? Because I'm not helping the situation if that's all I do. It is our job as Christians to pray for our leaders. We may think, well, they're not going to listen. They don't want to change. They might. I changed when I heard truth. You changed. They could too. We need to certainly do our part in that regard. Verses 6 and 7. Do not exalt yourself in the presence of the king. Do not stand in the place of the great. For it is better that he say to you, come up here, than that you should be put lower in the presence of the prince whom your eyes have seen. This proverb section reminds me so much of what Jesus talks about in Luke 14. You know, don't take the high seat. You take the lower seat, and then the master of the feast, if he calls you up, then you're honored. If he has to tell you to go sit somewhere else, that's embarrassing. That is certainly shameful. John?
It makes me think about Daniel when they were rounding all them up, how he was sought out for his qualities.
Yeah.
And he seemed like a fairly humble person,
yeah,
unless the law was pressing him against something godly. But
yeah,
he didn't put himself out there. He was called upon.
Yeah, you know, I think of his dealings with, what was the guy's name who was over them? Arioch, I think. He always seems to be humble and kind in his dealings with others. And did it pay off for Daniel? Certainly did. God was pleased with him with that. Good example, John. One other point with this. Turn to Proverbs 27. Let's look at verse 2. Proverbs 27, verse 2. If someone will read that one for us.
Let another man praise thee and not thine own mouth, a stranger and not thine own lips.
What great advice, right? You know, I don't know what it is about this desire to speak our own praises. It certainly happens. I used to talk about this in sports all the time because I would hear it all the time. It seems to have gotten a little better maybe lately. I don't know if they mean it, but at least they don't talk about themselves as much, or I haven't noticed it. You know what? If you're the greatest of all time, you don't have to tell anybody. Michael Jordan should never have to have a conversation with somebody where he had to say, you know, I was pretty good at basketball. I was decent. Yeah, we know. Everybody knows. And to make that application to us, when we are doing things that are good and doing things that are right, we don't have to blow a trumpet. People know. People will see it for what it is, and good people will appreciate you for it. Let other people praise you. Don't be arrogant, and don't try to seek to draw this attention to yourself. Because what happens then?
Set yourself up for a fall.
Yeah, you do. You do. How do people feel about arrogance? Oh man, who enjoys being around the arrogant person? It's kind of one thing to keep in mind. Romans 12 brings this out. A lot we could say about this verse, I know, but just to make a quick point. Romans 12, verse 3 says, "For I say, through the grace given to me, everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." Don't puff yourself up. Don't think more highly than you should. Be sober. Be clear-minded in your thoughts. Certainly about yourselves. People generally have a great deal of respect for the humble. It's a lot easier to respect that than those. How do people normally feel about the arrogant? Nauseated? Maybe that's just me. But that's how they typically come across and rub others. The humble, it's very, very easy to respect the humble. Good. Verse 8. "Do not go hastily to court, for what will you do in the end when your neighbor has put you to shame?" What happens when we jump into a situation without all the details and without all the facts?
Make bad decisions.
Certainly.
Make judgments that you shouldn't take.
Poor judgments. We make bad decisions. How does that make us end up looking?
Foolish.
Like a fool. Absolutely it does. I think that's the warning here. Just to some things we've already looked at. Turn back to chapter 14. Some of these ideas obviously are repeated throughout Proverbs. Proverbs 14, if someone will read verse 29.
He who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly.
Yeah, is it going back to the point that Donna and John made? You're just bringing foolishness on yourself. You're just bringing trouble. Another one, chapter 18. If someone will read verse 13 for us. He who answers a matter before listening. New King James says, he who answers a matter before he hears it. Now, just think about that. I'm going to give you my answer on this before I've even heard what the question is. You see any problems with the way that's setting itself up? And we read that and we think, well, surely nobody would do that. Yes. Yes, we would. We do it all the time. Why do we do it?
Being defensive. I'm putting the wall up. It's like, you can't approach me about this because I already know what I need.
I think that is the case a lot of times, is when someone won't listen to an issue. I've already made my mind up, and I don't care if it's right or wrong. I'm doing it. I'm doing it this way. And no matter what evidence you give me, I don't care. And so I'm going to cut you off right now, and I'm going to start talking before you've even told me. And the thing is, I may not even know what you're really trying to tell me, because I've cut you off before you even get a chance. That is foolish, foolish behavior. Here's the thing. And whatever the matter is, if I'm right in it, if the stance I take and the belief I have is correct, then what's the danger in letting you finish talking? I mean, if I'm right, am I still going to be right after you finish talking? Yeah. Now, in letting you talk, I may have learned some things as to why you don't believe it this way. I think this comes into play a lot of times when we have discussions with people about religious matters. If we get into this defensive mode where it's a me versus you type thing, we're going to make a mess. But if we hear people out, I may realize this is why he thinks this. It's because of this. Can that help me to teach him truth?
Yeah,
knowing the whole story, knowing why, and being able... You know, interrupting people and just refusing to see the whole story, that's just not a wise approach. We need to see the whole thing so we can treat the whole thing. And you know what? I may be wrong. I may just flat out be wrong. And I may need to hear the whole thing so I can be right. This is, again, I think that ties in with arrogance. I think sometimes the reason we don't listen is because we're afraid we might be wrong. And we don't want that exposed. So certainly be humble. Be willing to listen. Now, when the listening is complete and you have the whole story, now what is it time to do?
Fix it.
Yeah. If a rebuke's necessary, is it time to rebuke? Yeah. If correction is necessary, it's time to correct. If encouragement's necessary, it's time to encourage. But make sure we have the whole story before we just jump in there and, you know, bull in a china shop approach. Yeah.
And everyone's got a different way of learning too. You're going to have to take a different approach, and that's why you do have to listen.
Yes.
Some people are more fragile than others.
Yeah.
But if you go to somebody with something, you better be ready to say that you're sorry, too. Because sometimes you are wrong. If you're going to go and just accuse, and you can't go to them knowing that, you might have to tell them, hey, I'm sorry about this, but I needed to talk to you about this.
Yeah.
You better be able to go there and be a little bit humble, too, or you're going to lose.
Yeah. And the approach to take with someone... There is never, and I know people give encouragement for teaching others about the gospel and there's certainly things we can do. Every person is different, though, in the way that you approach them. Some are going to ask tons of questions, and they're easy to teach to. Some are very, very defensive. If I approach them both in the exact same way, there may be problems. I have to listen and see what does this person know? Because what if you take somebody and you start, let's see. Well, let's go back. Let's go back to the first century. What if you are teaching a Greek who grew up worshiping false gods? And you start talking to him about Moses and Abraham. And that's your starting point. Is that the best place? What does he know about Abraham and Moses? Nothing. It would be better to find a place of common ground where we can establish a foundation and start. It may be better to just go to the beginning. You know, you say Zeus created this. Let me give you this account. and let's go through it and let's see the wisdom of it. In the beginning, God created. And let's talk about that God. And certainly you see Paul actually doing that. You've got a place here to honor the unknown God. Let me tell you about the unknown God. You got every God covered, even the ones you don't know. Let me tell you about the one you don't know. That's wisdom. We need to have it. We'll be much more successful in bringing others to the Lord if we're wise about it. Wise as serpents. And this goes back to John's point. Harmless as doves. You know, there is a time to act. There is a time to be firm. There is a time to be stern. There's also a time to be gentle and long-suffering. I need to have enough sense to know the difference between those times. Now, is that always easy? Maybe not. That's where wisdom comes in. And it takes practice and it takes patience. Good. Any thoughts on anything through 8 so far? Let's look at 9 and 10 together. Debate your case with your neighbor and do not disclose the secret to another, lest he who hears it expose your shame and your reputation be ruined. When there is an issue between my neighbor and me, who needs to take care of it?
You and your neighbor.
My neighbor and me. And that is the best way to take care of it. Because when you start pulling other people in, what happens? It does. It's just a mess. You know, first of all, something that, and we've talked about this before actually when we were in Matthew 18, something that could have been dealt with and nobody else would even know about. It could have been handled without the issue going any further. Now it's all over the place. What happens if it's corrected?
Win that person over?
Yeah, that's good. What happens if it's corrected and everybody else knows about it and we correct it and we're good, you and me, but the 34 other people that we told about it don't realize it's corrected? Now what have we done? Reputation has been damaged, and that may never get fixed the way it should. We need to be careful. Issues between individuals need to be handled as best as possible, and certainly we've talked about it in Matthew 18. Are there times where you have to go beyond that, beyond the individual? Certainly there are. Try to fix it and try to keep it as contained and as peaceful without making a public issue of it as we possibly can. John?
This is just talking about with people in your regular dealings, and it's the exact same as rebuking somebody, the same process of pulling them off to the side and approaching them and then, you know, dealing with it. And the only difference is here, you know, this will ruin your reputation, but at church, you know, you might have to go get a group of people if they won't hear you to begin with. And then your reputation could be your body and your brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it's just good advice in general, whether you're dealing with your brothers and sisters or you're dealing with just
those outside. Yeah, absolutely. This does appear, if you notice verse 9, debate your case with your neighbor. This does appear to be a personal issue between one and another. This is not somebody teaching false doctrine from the housetops. This is an issue between me and you, and it needs to try and be handled between the two of us at all possible. Let's look at another point that's made, I think, that we can make from the end of verse 9. Do not disclose a secret to another. If we have been entrusted with sensitive information, people ought to be able to trust us to keep it. You know, have people ever confided in you? They told you things that others didn't know? What did they expect you to do with that? Have you ever confided in anyone and told them things that everybody else didn't know? What did you expect them to do with that? Keep it. Yeah, we know that's what we want when we confide in someone. Well, obviously, that's what everybody else wants too. What happens if I take that information and just blab it? What happens to me and my reputation?
You can't be trusted.
Nobody will tell you anything.
Now everybody knows. Don't tell Lance anything because he'll tell everybody. It damages our reputation. That's hard to overcome once we get known as, you know, a blabbermouth who just can't keep quiet about things. There are some things that need to be kept. Right? brethren will come to us asking for advice on very sensitive issues. They want, you know, they want some wisdom. They want some help. Maybe they want prayers. Let's give them that wisdom and that support and those prayers. Good. Anything else you want to bring out on anything? First 10 verses so far.
A lot of times we don't have too much trouble telling someone else's secret, but when someone tells them about it, we get upset about it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is something about that whole treat others as you would be treated thing. It actually makes a lot of sense. There are difficult things in this Bible. There are some issues that are difficult and they require, they are meat, they are chewy meat that you really, it takes time and wisdom. There's some things that are just common sense. There are a lot that are just simple. Treat others like you want to be treated. That's just, of course that makes sense. Look at verse 11. Well, really, let's read 11 and 12. I think they go together, and we can talk about them in as much detail as you like. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and settings of silver. Like an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold is a wise rebuker to an obedient ear. We'll start with 11, and then we can put them together however you like. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and settings of silver. We should be thoughtful and considerate in everything we do. We should be. Especially, that's true of the words we speak. You know, once those things come out, you can't take them back. You can say, I take them back, but you really can't because they already went out and they heard them. And now you just have to deal with the consequences of it. Have you ever seen someone send an email out that they really didn't mean to send? Maybe they didn't mean to send it to everybody, and then it disappears because they retracted it. Have you ever had that happen? At the bank it happened, and it goes out, and it was there in my inbox, and I read it, and I was like, ooh. And then it was gone because they pulled it back. I took it back. Well, you did. But me and anybody who checked at 10:10, we've read it now, and you can't really take it back. You just have to deal with the fallout. You have to deal with the consequences. So a word fitly spoken. What does that mean? What is a word fitly spoken?
It's spoken with wisdom. It's put together well.
Wise. Good. Good. What are some ways that a word is fitly or wisely spoken?
It fits in with the situation that the person is in. It takes thought before we speak. It may be encouragement. Sometimes encouragement when someone is, you know, had a loss of life in their fingers. You don't want to use the same things to that person that somebody that just bought a new car and you're rejoicing with them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, well, let's put some New Testament with it. Go to Ephesians 4. We'll look at a couple verses in the New Testament, and then we'll come back and make some more points about this. Ephesians 4, verse 29. This should be you and me. All of us in here who have obeyed the gospel. This should be us when we respond to someone. Ephesians 4, verse 29. Give you a second to get there. Verse 29, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Do I talk like that? Does that describe my speech? Let no corrupt word out of your mouth. None. None at all. I need to work on this. It's very easy to let some corrupt and wasted words get in there. What is good for necessary edification. Now, this is not all. Certainly, there's a lot of good and a lot of things that are merciful that include in this. But even a rebuke, wouldn't it fall in this? A rebuke may be good for necessary edification. I need to do it, but I still need to do it without corrupt words. My heart needs to be right. My words need to be right. Those things need to be, as Les said, thought out very well beforehand, so it imparts grace to the hearers. One other place, Colossians. Let's look at Colossians 4. I think this really goes back to a point that John made earlier. Colossians 4, verse 6. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. That tells me that you don't answer each one in exactly the same manner. It's going to take some wisdom in how to approach each one. You've got someone who just obeyed the gospel and they are struggling with sin and struggling with putting things away. I would approach them a lot differently than somebody who has been a Christian for 30 years and just flat out rebelled because they didn't want to. They just got tired. I'm going to do what I want to do. Do you approach them in the same manner? Well, here's a babe in Christ that is trying to the best of his ability to get things right. You approach him gently and you do your best to guide him gently. Here's a brother who has decided to go into full-blown rebellion. That's just completely different. We need to be wise and make sure our approach is appropriate to whatever case.
One thing I noticed about this 11 and 12 is, mm-hmm. you know, you're supposed to be speaking to your peers like your equals, because they're comparing gold to gold and silver to silver. So even if you're being wise in how you're choosing your words, you need to talk to them the same way you want to be talked to. And talk to them understanding they might be wiser than you too. And you could get something back from them.
Could be. Good. Great. Great thoughts. Fitly spoken is the right words at the right time in the right manner. That's fitly spoken. All of those things go together. If it is hard to speak fitting words when I'm volatile, when my heart's out of control, it's going to be very hard for me to pick the right words at the right time and the right way when I'm all over the place. I need to have control of myself. This goes back to what Les said. Ahead of time, know what you're going to say. Think about it. Don't just bust in there. I mentioned a bull in a china shop earlier. Don't do that. That's not good. Think it out. Know what you're going to say. And put 12 with it. A wise rebuke is like precious gold. It's like treasure. We're told in Galatians 6 to restore one another in a spirit of meekness, lest we also be led astray. The one doing the rebuke needs to do it from a pure heart, for the right reason, the right point in mind. Not to win an argument, but because the soul is going to be lost. And I'm trying to get them to repent. I'm trying to get them to do what's right. Now, he has a responsibility, the rebuker. What about the one being rebuked? Does he or she, do they have responsibilities? What are they?
To listen.
Yeah. Listen, an obedient ear. Listen and make sure if the rebuke is appropriate. What should I do?
Fix it.
Yeah, absolutely. Obey. Be obedient. Fix it. Take care of whatever. If the rebuke's not appropriate, well, then we need to talk. And I need to explain the situation. And either way, I need to be willing to listen. I wonder if this is the problem with a lot of trouble that comes up, certainly in our daily lives, but also in the church. I wonder if it's just a case a lot of times of people not listening to each other. I remember talking with Bill Hall about issues that came up in the 50s, in the 60s, and he said, looking back, one of the biggest problems was brethren weren't listening to each other. They were accusing each other of taking this stance based on this. And that was absolute nonsense. You had brethren getting accused of things like they didn't support using the church treasury for outside organizations and things like that. And they were accused of, well, the reason you do that is because you hate orphans. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that's the reason, right? These Christians, bought in the blood of Jesus, they just hate orphans. That's what. Is that really? I mean, are we being serious here? They didn't listen to each other. They didn't get to the heart of the matter. We do that, and we may see that and say, whoa, we would never make those kinds of issues. We would never jump to those conclusions. We will if we don't listen. We will. I need to know what the issue is before we can talk about it. That's going to take patience. It's going to take willingness to listen. And if someone's wrong, after all that's been done, rebuke them. But do it because you want them to go to heaven. And not because you want to win an argument. Matthew.
You know, it made me think about Job. The whole, almost the whole thing is a discussion between his friends, and at points his friends mock him, they tell him he's wrong. And yet he still hears out their arguments, but then he lays out his. And even at some points you can just really see he's distressed because the only things he has left is friends to comfort, and they give none. he still hears them out, and then when they're wrong, corrects them. And then when they still go back into a mocking or incorrect, or they're being incorrect, he still is patient with them and lets them talk, given all that he was doing.
Yeah. For you've heard of the patience of Job. And if you're up to speed on your reading, you have seen the patience of Job this past week and a half. With friends like that, who needs enemies, right? They have their own opinions and they speak them. But Matthew's right. Job allowed them to complete their arguments. And it actually continues to go on. I don't know how long Job would have listened to it. Finally, God just says, enough. And he solves the whole thing. When he speaks, then it's over. The conversation is done. And Job respects that as well, too. Norris, you had something?
Yeah, I was going to say, you're talking about choosing the words, you know, and I guess people ain't learning from other people. You see somebody mad about something, and they tweet something out or something like that, and just saying all kinds of stuff. And then 5 minutes later, they redo it because they don't realize they made a fool of themselves. I'd be like, what did you do that 5 minutes ago when you said that? You know, and people not thinking it. You see that so much now that people say things out of anger, and they put it out on TV, and then when people respond to it, then the second time they put out something, they told a different person.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, I don't know that person the first time, you know, and how people let anger just make them just say it all kinds of things.
It does.
You know, it's just a shame. You know? And this day and time seemed like nobody learned from it.
Yeah. You know, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it is a folly and shame to him. And it's still true 3,000 years later. It's even more accessible now thanks to Facebook and Twitter and all that other stuff. It's so quick now. Now it gets out immediately. So we have to be even more careful than maybe in times past. If I was mad at Norris and I wrote him a sternly worded letter, well, before I sent it by horseback to him, I might have had time to think about what. Now all I got to do is hit the. I mean, all I got to do is click. Yeah, that's what I think about that. We got to be careful and think these things out. Make sure these words are fitly spoken. Kristen.
I mean, this is quite obvious, but I mean, when it says here, it means you're listening. You're truly listening. Yeah. You're not just waiting until I finish running their mouth and not paying attention to what they say and thinking through, okay, well, my next step is this.
Yes.
You've got to really be listening to what they're saying.
Yeah. That is a trap we can fall into as well. We especially when studying with others, we may say, okay, I'm going to let him have his say. I'm not paying attention to anything he's saying. I'm thinking, I'm formulating my next argument to counter. I listen to the first four words he says, and I know that Ephesians 4 will take care of that. So he's just talking, and as soon as he stops and takes a breath, I'm going to hit him with this. That's not listening. It's not. That's fighting and just trying to win. Be wise. Be patient. These things, certainly this takes time, and I say this, thinking back on conversations I've had and think, boy, I just blew it. How badly I failed at doing what I should have done. Because the whole time I was going to point B, but I should have still been listening to point A. Okay, let's... one side point to put with this. We think, a lot of times, I think we get it into our head, when we bring a rebuke to someone, it's always going to be accepted negatively. They're going to be mad about it. That's just not true. Those who love the Lord and those who are wise, when you point out something that is inconsistent or is wrong in their life, they may take it and look at it for a while. They will appreciate you for it. If you're right, you bring them something, you point out error in their life, if their heart is right, they will be glad that you pointed it out to them. And they will love you for it. The wise, the righteous, they will love those who correct them. David talks about that. And others we see being thankful for the wisdom that pulled them out. Do you think that David was thankful to Nathan for pointing out his sin? Yeah. Sure he was. Why did Nathan do it? I know God gave him the instruction, but why did Nathan do it from his own perspective?
For fear of the repercussions and for loving his brother.
Here you go. He feared the Lord, so he's going to do it for that reason. You think Nathan loved David? Of course he did. This needed to be corrected. Because with David being in the position of king, David's sin not only affects David, the whole nation of Israel is affected by it. Nathan loved his people as well. That's why he brought it. David appreciated it. And it was rough. I mean, there were some rough consequences that come after that. But it got David back to where he needed to be. And the wise understand that. We don't always need it. We can tell ourselves the very worst will happen if I do what I'm supposed to. You do what you're supposed to. The righteous will appreciate it. Okay, let's stop there. That will have you guys next week picking up in verse 13 of chapter 25. Appreciate the comments this morning.